Today, however, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Father Kenneth Himes, who is professor of theology here at Boston College and is also the chair for a few fleeting weeks in the theology department here. He earned his PhD in religion and public policy from Duke University, and before joining the faculty at BC, he taught at the Washington Theological Union. He's a member of the Order of Friars Minor, or Franciscans, and has held multiple leadership positions within his religious community. He served as president of the CTSA, the Catholic Theological Society of America, and also has been a long member of the Society of Christian Ethics. His research interests include the history of Catholic social teaching, the role of U.S. Catholic community in American social reform, ethics of war, and the relationship of religion and politics to our nation's public life. He's the author of Responses to 101 Questions on Catholic Social Teaching, and edited one of the editors, along with a couple others in this room or in the department, of this terrific book, Modern Catholic Social Teaching, as well. So today you'll be here to talk about the uplifting topic of torture, but we thought that it was especially apropos for a discussion on this day of remembrance for those who served in our armed forces. So in honor of Veterans Day, we appreciate your time here, Father Himes, and look forward to your talk.
Thank you, Eric. Good afternoon, everybody. I see some new faces and some familiar ones. So, in fact, I think I could call a department meeting here. We might have a quorum. Just a word about how I got into this question. I was asked to do by the editor of Theological Studies, was approached, would I do an article on sort of the aftermath of the Iraqi conflict? And what do we make of this? How would one begin at least an initial assessment of the U.S. engagement in Iraq? And I decided fairly early on to organize that under sort of the three traditional headings, or three classical headings, of just war theory, and deal with the jus ad bellum, the jus in bello, the jus post bello, justice in going to war, justice in war, justice after war. The jus ad bellum issue suggested itself pretty clearly. It was the whole debate about preventive war, and the idea of waging war to prevent something happening. That was debated much before the conflict began and continues to be debated in the literature. So the idea of whether preventive war is a legitimate cause pretty clearly became the topic I would focus on in that area. For the jus post bellum, it seemed to me what suggested itself was either to do something on the ethics of occupation and how one behaves as an occupying force in a foreign land, or to do something on the whole question of transition. How does one move from being the occupying force to an exit strategy and handing over sovereignty to the native nation? And so that became kind of the focus for the jus post bello. The jus in bello, I went back and forth. I thought perhaps do something on counterinsurgency and look at the Army Manual on Counterinsurgency that Petraeus had helped to author, and that was much of the, you might say, foundational background for what became known popularly as the surge and what's gone on in terms of turning around the security situation in Iraq after the disastrous years of 2005 and 2006. But it seemed to me that in some ways the topic that had not been dealt with much in the theological literature, and that's why I chose this, was the question of treatment of detainees. And there was a fair amount of literature out there, popular, as you know. I mean, Jane Meyer's book, The Dark Side, Mark Danner's book, Torture and Truth, Philippe Sands' book, Torture Team, lots of articles in the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, and, you know, good journalism. There was lots of stuff out there about what happened, or why did it happen, or what led up to it, and the like. But there wasn't a great deal of literature in theology on sort of some of the, I might say, the moral or theological dimensions of the question. And so I decided to focus on treatment of detainees for the jus post bellum, or rather the jus in bello issue. Now, I wasn't terribly interested in what we did. I think that was pretty much, out there. There's no need for me to rehearse that. The International Committee on the Red Cross, the Senate Armed Services Committee under Senator Levin, both of them had multiple reports. It seems to me the case is pretty clear. We tortured people. And it's pretty clear that it wasn't just a few bad apples. It was systematic. I think that's almost beyond debate at this point. But that wasn't the focus of my writing. What I came to see was three key issues, really, in thinking about this religiously or ethically. One, how does one define torture? That's clearly has lots of legal dimensions to it, but it's not just a legal question, how one defines torture. Secondly, why is it wrong? Now, you might say, well, isn't it sort of self-evident that it's wrong? But what's interesting is that the strength of conviction that it's wrong and the degree to which people look upon torture as being particularly heinous, such that people who are perfectly, or not perfectly, but at least willing to countenance the idea of killing someone would not countenance the idea of torturing someone. What is it about torture that it seemed to be even more difficult morally than to take someone's life? And then the third question is, granted, at face value, everyone thinks torture is something we ought not to do, but is that prohibition to be considered without exception, or is it something that, in fact, could be justified under certain circumstances or for certain reasons? What I want to do today is focus a little bit really on that last question. I'm perfectly willing to talk about the other two and give and take, but for the time we have, the focus just on the last question. Now, the thing to understand, of course, is no one is seriously arguing for torture for many of the traditional historical reasons why people tortured. People have tortured in the past as punishment, a way of punishing people. No one's really arguing for that today. Perhaps the most common reason for torture historically was to extract confessions from people. Part of this, of course, was before the modern era of jurisprudence and rules of evidence. It was very hard to convict people of a crime unless they admitted it. Torturing people to get them to confess to something was a very common thing in many parts of the world for a great many centuries. And of course, historically, it's been the rationale for why organized religion has often been involved with torture. Namely, heresy and apostasy were seen to be crimes against God. And so torture was employed to extract confessions from heretics or apostates. Nor today are people arguing for torture as a kind of force magnifier. That is, this is not to say these things don't happen, but no one's making intellectual arguments for them, is what I'm saying. It's been not uncommon historically to use torture to terrorize people. Tyrants will hold on to their power even though they may have only a small percentage of the population supporting them in power, but if everyone knows the palace guard or the militia or the military or the police are willing to torture wantonly people who oppose the tyrant, it is a way of deterring any sort of political action against a dictatorial regime. And also, of course, one has seen torture historically simply as a result of military victory, that a number of historians of war have talked about, that sometimes soldiers engage in torture just simply because they can. It's a way of expressing their complete domination and victory over someone who's been vanquished. Again, those reasons are not what's at stake here in play, it seems to me, in the intellectual debates that are going on. The sole reason for torture as it's come back on the agenda in this country and in much of the West is simply torture as a tool for interrogation. And why this has become so important is everyone recognizes that a key component of any counterterrorism strategy is information. Or to use the jargon of the DC Beltway, actionable intelligence. That is, in order to foil terrorists, you need to get information about terrorist plots, terrorist networks, and do that in a way that's sufficiently detailed and sufficiently timely that you can stop any future terrorist activity. And of course, if we all put ourselves back into the mindset of late 2001 and early 2002, there was a good deal of panic over the possibilities of future terrorist attacks, either on U.S. soil or in other places. There was great concern about what were the resources and the capabilities of global terrorism. And so in that sort of climate, arguments for the necessity to engage in what was called enhanced interrogation that might or might not have involved cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or even torture or what's sometimes called torture light. This became a huge issue in national security circles and in political circles in this country. Now, when this question comes up, and, well, how might one justify the case for torture in that kind of climate, a climate that Drew Christensen, the editor of America, called a few years ago, back in 2002, a state of moral panic in this nation, where all of a sudden we began to talk about doing things that previously we had never even considered. In doing my research, which I've been doing for the past 7 months, really, I came across an Encyclopedia Britannica article from 1911, which begins with the line, I'm not giving it to you exactly, but begins with the line, "Happily, discussions of torture have left the civilized world." You know? Well, I don't know what that says about our world now, but torture's back. But what's really fascinating is when you look at the literature, the pros and cons of this debate about the possibility of some reasons for torture, it's striking how one argument or one scenario, not even an argument really, how one scenario comes up again and again and again in the literature. And that is what's been called the ticking time bomb scenario. It basically follows, you can change the some of the details, but the basic format is a terrorist has planted a nuclear weapon. It wasn't a nuclear weapon back when it was first formulated, but now it's a nuclear weapon. I guess inflation leads to that. We go from bombs to weapons of mass destruction. But a nuclear weapon has been planted in a major urban setting. Frequently, it's called Manhattan. Authorities apprehend the terrorist. They know that he knows where the bomb is. It's about to go off in a fairly imminent time frame. Can you torture this terrorist in order to save tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives? What's interesting is pretty much the presentation of the scenario becomes the argument. It almost, from that point on, most commentators just simply presume at a sort of intuitive, self-evident appeal, well, of course you would, and they go on from there. The case, as far as I've been able to track it, first appears in a novel written in France by a former military figure who was part of the French-Algerian War, wrote a book called The Centurions, in which he formulated this idea of the ticking time bomb scenario. It wasn't a nuclear weapon back then. But it was made into a movie, which I don't think I've ever seen, starring Anthony Quinn. I don't know if any of you remembered seeing it in the late 50s. But what really brought the ticking time bomb scenario to sort of at least recognition among intellectuals and academics was a famous essay by Michael Walzer entitled Dirty Hands. Dirty Hands, the Problem of Dirty Hands, Political Action, the Problem of Dirty Hands, which appeared in the journal Philosophy and Public Affairs a number of years ago. Walzer wasn't dealing with torture per se. What he was dealing with was what he saw as the classic problem of the leader of the state who, because of fiduciary and stewardship responsibilities as a leader of state, might have to do things which everyone would recognize were wrong, but which were necessary to do. And how does one come to terms with the fact that being a leader in certain political situations, one finds oneself having to get one's hands dirty? Now, that was Walzer's basic point.
the scenario of the ticking time bomb was one example that he used of trying to make his case, but it wasn't an essay per se on torture. Now, when you look at the literature, and I'll stop in a few moments and allow for some conversation here, but when you look at the literature, broadly speaking, it seems to me it breaks down into three classes of argument. There's a school of thought that simply makes the case that torture is justified. This is almost always done on a fairly utilitarian basis. The argument is pretty much from utility. Fritz Ahlhoff, a philosopher out in California, has been perhaps the academic whose essay gets cited most commonly for this because he's quite unapologetic about justifying torture. Charlie Krauthammer wrote a very popular essay in the Weekly Standard a number of years ago in which, with somewhat, by my lights, typical Krauthammer invective, kind of puts this thing out there in a very provocative way. And frankly, Dick Cheney, since he's left office in some of his more recent statements, has been much more direct and blunt about that torture can be justified. The person who, in the eyes of some people, incongruously, has been also identified with defending torture, of course, is the great civil libertarian Alan Dershowitz. In some ways, I think that's an unfair criticism of him. Dershowitz's view, I think, is more... I think his argument goes something like this, and he's argued it in lots of places. Basically, Dershowitz's argument is, we're going to have torture. There's going to be torture. So ought not we try to get a handle on this, rather than it being done by decisions behind closed doors, in dark alleyways and hallways? Shouldn't we bring it out to the light of day, examine it, test it, make arguments for torture, be justified? In other words, his argument really is trying to, what he sees as, protect processes of transparency and openness in a democracy. And therefore, he argues for a system of warrants for torture, that people would have to go before a special torture court and make the case that in this case torture could be justified. He's gotten a lot of flack for this. Elaine Scarry, one of his friends over at Harvard, has written a clever little essay, Five Reasons Why Alan Dershowitz is Wrong. Not exactly the topic you want to read about yourself, the reasons why you're wrong. But her, among her arguments, one of them that I think is quite compelling is she says, in effect, this won't regulate or control torture, it will increase it. People who are willing to torture now, in the face of absolute prohibitions, are not going to stop because they don't have a warrant. So they're going to continue to torture. Whereas people who might not have tortured under other circumstances, if they're given a warrant, will torture. So what Dershowitz's formulation will do really is increase the net number of torturers that are out there and the possibilities of torture. But it's also been pointed out that his plans for regularizing this and the like is offensive to people like Jean Elshtain, Eric's old professor. Elshtain does not rule out the possibility of torture using the second argument I'll mention in a moment, but her view is government ought not to be seen as regularizing or overseeing or controlling this. That government should be very clear, this is wrong. We don't do it. We don't like it. And that anything that makes the U.S. government, or any government, seem to be complicit with torture is a huge mistake. What's also been pointed out, of course, is if you're familiar with the FISA court system that's used presently for gaining warrants for wiretaps and the like for national security reasons, estimates are that there have been about 25,000 requests for FISA warrants. To the present day, I think we know of one that's been turned down, one appeal. So the argument is that basically in climates as polarized and as, you might say, panicked as the United States national security climate has been for recent years, judges are not going to challenge people requesting torture warrants. They're going to acquiesce, just as they do with the FISA courts, that basically they rubber stamp such requests. The second school of thought, the one that Elshtain represents, is really the Michael Walzer argument. Mark Bowden, the journalist, writes in Atlantic Monthly, had a similar column, makes the case. This is the dirty hands argument. Call torture wrong, call it morally reprehensible, ban it legally, be very clear about that, denounce torture. But if there's ever the extreme case, like the ticking time bomb, a person's got to do what they got to do, but then they have to face the music for doing it. In effect, basically saying that leaders must be willing to conscientiously disobey the law at times for some greater good, namely national security. That's the argument of the Dirty Hands crowd, and it's an argument that seems to me that in some ways appeals particularly to a Lutheran mindset, which may be why Gene Elstein likes it, but that does it. And then the final school of thought are those people who continue to argue for an absolute ban, who argue that we simply should not allow or permit torture for any reason. And this, too, runs the gamut of different views. People like Alex Bellamy, David Roden, Jessica Wolfendale, all fine political scientists, Australia, England, and here in the U.S. now, basically take a kind of just war argument on this, that this simply violates all the norms of jus in bello treatment, whether it be Geneva Conventions or other agreements, and this simply should not be accepted. David Lubin and Jeffrey Waldron, two well-known professors of law at Georgetown and at Columbia, have argued in several places for an absolute ban, and arguing basically that the ticking time bomb case, to use Lubin's phrase, is an intellectual fraud. And also, we can talk about that if you want, but also that, you know, clearly the consensus of the international law community is this has to be banned and stay banned. David Gushy, an evangelical theologian, George Hunzinger, a Reformed tradition theologian, Gene Porter, a Catholic theologian, have all written powerful essays about the simple incongruity of torture with Christian tenets and Christian conscience. Elaine Scarry, I mentioned before, Michael Davis, philosophers have argued against it as well. Basically, the arguments come down to three schools of thought, and I'll stop here. One is a kind of classic deontological view. For many of the philosophers and the lawyers, it's a kind of Kantian argument of respect for persons. For many of the theologians, it's an argument that ultimately comes down to respect for persons, but it's frequently couched in the language of respecting the image of God. The human being is created in the image of God. The Imago Dei doctrine is a reason for why one ought not to allow this. There's the utilitarian argument, one that it's counterproductive. This is not to say it's ineffective. There are people who argue torture doesn't work, but there's plenty of other people prepared to argue that it does work. And as you know, there's some of those debates going on in our country right now. That's part of what Dick Cheney's involved in, did it work or not. But there's a very interesting fellow, Darius Rejali, who's a social scientist out at Reed College in Oregon, has written a fabulous book. Those of you who are social scientists, I'd recommend it to you, called Torture and Democracy, in which he's done, from what I can see, the most extensive empirical studies on torture. And what he argues is it's profoundly counterproductive, and was so even under the Nazis. His argument is that the single most important thing in countering terrorism is information. And one of the best ways of getting information is getting cooperation of locals. And one of the quickest ways of ensuring locals will not cooperate with you is if you are perceived to be torturers. And that, in fact, whether you're doing police work in a city, you know you have to walk the beat and befriend people on the beat to get to know what's happening in the neighborhood. Petraeus' whole strategy of getting out in patrols and being with people, talking with people, getting out from behind, you know, force barriers and the like. You have to engage people and get information that way, and people will simply shut down and turn away from you if you are seen to be part of the torture team. So Rejali arguments, not just in Iraq, but you can see this again and again and again in the history of counterterrorism, torture actually is counterproductive in terms of getting information. But there's also, of course, and many of you who may be here for Veterans Day will appreciate this, much of the opposition to torture comes from the uniformed military, who argue that, in fact, this puts our own military in increasingly harm's way, because the risk to our military that there'll be torture of our people because we are seen to be torturers is another reason why many people oppose torture. And in some ways, that was John McCain's argument early on when he was pushing for the McCain Amendment. Another reason, of course, is what Rajali and others demonstrate is torture metastasizes. That is, inevitably, like in the ticking time bomb argument, you can torture this person because you know he knows. But in reality, we never know he knows. We have strong suspicions he knows, or we have hunches that he knows. And therefore, inevitably, you wind up torturing not based on certitude, you wind up torturing based on hunches, suspicions, rumors, whatever. It's interesting, of course, that of the first 5,000 people who were rounded up and run through Bagram Air Force Base, that many of whom were subjected at least to cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, if not outright torture, out of those first 5,000 people rounded up, I think we came out with 7 convictions. So when what happens is you start casting a very wide net, you bring people in, you start torturing to get people to turn their neighbors in or whatever, people start saying things to avoid torture, and then you start bringing more people in who get named in the investigations. But also what Rajali shows that's interesting is torture comes home. That it's a fairly compelling argument he makes that many of those who tortured in the Vietnam War wound up coming home and joining local police forces. And that rates of abusive treatment in interrogation in many of our major urban areas went up in the late 60s and 70s. And it's because, he argues, there's about a 20-year lifespan to torture after a war, when a generation of people who lived with it continue to, at times, resort to it in certain settings. And then the final argument, besides the utilitarian and the deontological, is an argument from virtue. It's the argument, again, John McCain voiced this to some extent during his primary campaign, you recall. We don't do this because of who we are. That in some ways torture violates our values, either individually or collectively. And that's the reason we should oppose torture, irrespective of questions of utility or what the other side is doing or anything else. It's about who we are more than about who they are. Why don't I stop with that and open this up for some conversation and back and forth.
Well, thank you.